Our passage starts, verse 13. Who is wise and understanding among you? It's the question that we've been wrestling with together for the last 3 weeks. Who is wise and understanding among you? Seriously, this isn't a rhetorical question. Like, this is actually one of the most important and practical questions that James could ask a local church. Who are the people among you who are living lives that are worthy of imitation? It's a question that anyone who is seeking Jesus should be able to answer. Remember how James started chapter 3. He started by saying, not many of you should become teachers, my brothers and sisters. Not many of you should become teachers. Not because there are just many of you who are just not supposed to teach. James explains, not many of you should become teachers because there are not many of you who are wise and understanding. In any congregation of people who are following Jesus, there are those who have become wise and understanding, and there are those who aren't yet wise and understanding. And James is trying to help us see and name the wise and the understanding among us. Because he wants us to identify the people who should be teaching us how to obey everything that Jesus taught. Here's what James is after. If you want to follow Jesus, if you want to grow, you should identify the people who are wise and understanding among you so that you can go close to them and learn how to walk with Jesus and learn how to follow him. I don't know about you, but when I hear James's question, like, I'm tempted to answer, who is wise and understanding among you, by going, huh, I should listen, right? Who says the most profound stuff? Who seems to always have a good answer or a right answer or something that just seems deep? Who knows the most? Who are the most gifted communicators among us? Who do I like listening to? Turns out James doesn't care about any of that stuff. James has another way. In fact, James is ultimately, principally concerned with what the New Testament calls the way. You may already know this, but the way is how the earliest followers of Jesus identified themselves and then were identified by others. They were members of the way because they were committed to a way of living. They were really creative in their branding. They were committed to living a way of life that was altogether different from any of the patterns of this world. They were committed to the wisdom that comes from above rather than what James calls earthly wisdom. And last week we began to look at what this means, this distinction between wisdom from above and earthly wisdom. And we looked at what James means when he says that before anything else, the wisdom from above is pure. According to James, living a pure life means living a life that's unstained by the values and by the priorities of our world. Another way to say it is a pure life is found in rejecting the patterns and practices of our world in favor of the patterns and practices of God's kingdom. Patterns and practices that we see in Jesus. So then, the really practical question becomes for us, if we're supposed to identify the people who are wise and understanding among us, how do we identify a pure life? Well, James tells us that the starting place for purity is to look at the people around you and to look at who fills their lives. Who do they surround themselves with? James tells us to look, to actually see who they honor. Look at where people spend their time and their energy. And this is the distinction he makes. Is it with the orphans and widows of our world? Those people that our world routinely says have no status, have no importance, have no value, have nothing to offer us or the church or the kingdom, those who are routinely forgotten. Do the people among us surround themselves with widows and orphans? Or those who sort of fall into that category? Or are the people among us constantly surrounded by the people who can advance their careers or status or their standing in society, their position in the community? And this is really a question of movement upwards or movement downwards, a movement upwards toward the bigger and toward the better and toward the glamorous and toward the glory is, for James, the very heart of wisdom that comes from the earth. What James calls unspiritual or demonic wisdom. But to move down toward the small, the seemingly insignificant, to move into the margins of society, among sinners and the forgotten, into obscure places. This is where we find Jesus. This is where the purity of the kingdom is formed in us. And I think you can see why wisdom is first pure. We have to be purified from the corrupting influence of our world that tells us success is an upward movement. We have to be purified of that so that we can embrace a life that moves down. Daniel gets it. Which means that we actually have to learn how to redefine all of the categories of our lives. That we actually have to adopt new values. That we have to tell new stories. That we have to embrace new definitions. And all of this so that Jesus can form new practices and new habits in us, which allow us to live in an altogether different way in this world. It is important for us to understand that the list that James gives us here in our passage in chapters 13 through 14, when he begins to list off the characteristics of wisdom, and he says that wisdom is peaceable, and he says it's gentle, and it's open to reason, and it's full of mercy and good fruits, and it's impartial, and it's sincere. All of these things can be lived out purely according to the patterns of the kingdom that Jesus is king over. But each of these characteristics can actually also be lived out in earthly and unspiritual and demonic ways. Each of these attributes can be shaped by jealousy. They can be used as tools for selfish ambition. Next week we'll talk about gentleness, but you can be gentle to gain favor with people that will help you move up. Is that the gentleness that James is inviting us into. This morning, we are going to explore the wisdom of peacemaking. But to do that, we're going to have to be honest about the fact that there is a kind of peace that is earthly, that is unspiritual, that is demonic. And that there is a kind of peace that is from above. But before we kind of flesh this out, I want to sort of wrap up these opening reflections on James's question, who is wise and understanding among us? Because I think this will help us to consider what it means that the wisdom from above is described as peaceable. That we're not actually called to be people who just believe in peace. Nor are we people who are to be looking to sort of feel peace. Jesus is inviting us to be people who make peace. And this reminds us that the early followers of Jesus were not simply committed to better ideas. They weren't just committed to better beliefs about the world and about what might be possible. The early followers of Jesus were committed to living according to God's way. Jesus opened the way to us as his death and his resurrection set us free from the power of sin and our fear of death. Jesus opened the way for us. But just as important, Jesus shows us how to walk in the way so that now that we are free, we have direction and we actually can begin to walk in this life. And you can't just believe that a way is good. It's not enough to see a way and go, oh, that looks like a good way. And we can't just talk about a way and go, let me tell you about this way of living that is great. A way is meant to be walked and lived. And as we are walking and living on the way, we are inviting others into this way that brings life and that is good. And so Jesus told his disciples to teach everyone to obey, which is an uncomfortable word for most of it. We tend to think of authority figure pointing at us saying, you must do this. Jesus is teaching his disciples, or telling his disciples to teach everyone to obey, to walk, to live out everything that he taught them, because this way is good, because this way brings life, because this way heals. This is exactly what James is now doing in this letter. This letter is an act of obedience to Jesus, because James is writing to new followers of Jesus scattered throughout the world, and he's teaching young Christians that there is no place for bitter jealousy or selfish ambition on the way with Jesus. And you might ask yourself, where would James get this idea? Where would this idea come from that we shouldn't, our lives shouldn't be filled with bitter jealousy or driven by selfish ambition? Well, we know that James is just passing on what he got from Jesus, because as you read the stories about Jesus, you can't help but then bump into the stories of Jesus' disciples, his closest friends, and at almost every turn, bitter jealousy and selfish ambition is dripping off of the pages. Right, as they're arguing with each other over, Jesus is busy calling them to lives of service and humility, and they're busy bickering with each other, which one of us is going to be the greatest in the kingdom? Jesus is busy telling them how to reorder themselves at tables, how to take the least spot, and they're fighting over the place of honor. They were constantly jealous of each other. They thought that they were better than people like Samaritans. They thought they were better than children who had little honor in that culture. They thought they were better than lepers and sinners. They fought with each other, and it was not pretty. Which means this group of disciples spent years walking with Jesus as he was so patient and so gracious with them. And they learned from him along the way and they grew. Before Jesus would have ever described them as wise and understanding and sent them off to teach. It was only after the disciples saw Jesus' willing, deliberate, self-emptying death for rebels, for enemies, that they were looking on Jesus and everything changed for them. They finally understood what they had been invited into from the very beginning. And filled with the very spirit of Jesus, you begin to see the disciples live this completely different way. They live the way. As you read the book of Acts, which picks up the story that the Gospels are telling, you discover it's telling a very different story about these disciples. These disciples aren't now sinless or perfect in some sinless way, but man, they have grown. And Jesus has entrusted to them the teaching, the passing on of what he taught them. The book of Acts is actually really interesting when we think about the fact that right at the center of the book, some scholars say that it is like the event in the book of Acts, perhaps the most amazing miracle in the entire book, and people get like raised from the dead in that book, is a church meeting. And during this church meeting, peace is made. Peace is made between two groups, Jews and Gentiles, who for history, for most of history, had been at odds with each other in various ways. And do you know who is right at the center of that peacemaking event in Acts chapter 15? A guy named James. James. Which should encourage us in a few ways, right? If you do an honest examination of your life, if you've, I've encouraged you guys to do this. I don't know if any of you have been bold enough to invite the people around you to speak into your life and to answer this question, am I wise in understanding according to the wisdom from above? But if you've looked at your life and you go, I'm not there yet, the great news is, like, you're not alone. We all start where the disciples started. And every one of us is invited to keep walking. And we experience Jesus' patience with us. And we experience his grace as he teaches us, as we learn from him. And this journey is filled with failure and also with grace and also with growth. If you are not capable of doing something as incredible or extreme as like building your own house, there are some skills you could learn to begin moving towards being able to do that. But you start small, you start somewhere. If you are not wise in understanding, there are some practices that you can learn. Practices around making peace, a small place to start, but for James, an essential place to start. Peacemaking for us is not optional. It's the starting point of a life with Christ because, as we learned last week, what God has done for us is then the thing that he is asking us to offer to others. And so if he has made peace with us, then we move, transformed by that peace, then turn and go, how can we be agents? How can we be workers of this peace in the world and in people's lives around us? So who is wise and understanding among us? One way to answer that question is anyone who, as a habit, makes peace in the church and in the world. And I want you to think about that. Are there people among us who as a habit make peace in the church and in the world? This is not a rhetorical question. You should be able to answer this question as you participate in this family week after week. In fact, next week we elect church board members who serve our church as overseers. This is what we are declaring when we affirm somebody in this role, that these are people who demonstrate that they are filled with the wisdom from above. Not that they're perfect, but that they are being transformed by God's wisdom. And we ought to see them making peace in our midst. It's worth pointing out that we identify the people who are living out the wisdom from above. They don't usually tell you how wise they are. Anybody who tells you how wise and understanding, how much understanding they have, should be nervous. So this was, you may have noticed after a couple weeks that each of these kind of sermons have kind of two parts. There's the part where we dig into the characteristic of wisdom, and that's what we're going to sort of enter into. But the first part is really this reflection on what does it mean to follow Jesus and to allow him to transform us, to allow him to bring us into this life of wisdom. And so we're talking about like kind of the wisdom from a big picture, and then we kind of narrow down into the attribute, the characteristic. And so let's take a look at peacemaking. And I don't intend for this to be exhaustive, because as you guys are meeting in your small groups, I've given you some resources to wrestle with this and to begin to put it into practice. And so my hope here is to sort of give you some categories to think about, some ways of kind of working through this a little bit, so that then when you go into your small groups, you're ready to say, this is the thing that Jesus is leading me to do. These are places where I need to be a peacemaker. And so peacemaking, what is this peace from above? How does one practice peacemaking? What does it look like for peacemaking to become a spirit-formed habit in your life? I want to start answering that by pointing to three kinds of peace that I think are not included in the wisdom from above. These are what I sometimes sort of think of as like pretend peace. Pretend peace makes me think a little bit of like fast food. It's easy when you're in a hurry. It often tastes good. It doesn't generally cost as much as healthier food. But in the end, it's mostly empty calories. And we're usually less healthy when we've settled for it. And if it's our only diet, we're dying. That's dramatic, but I think also if our only if pretend peace is the only kind of peacemaking that we are engaged in, we're probably dying in faith. Pretend peace tricks us into settling for something that's less than what God made us for. And so when you look at each of these pretend forms of peace, you realize that they have no real connection with the life that Jesus lived, what he did, who he is, and who he's calling us to be. And so the first, I'll run through these, and if you're taking notes, you're gonna want to list these three, because when we spend a few minutes talking about this in some smaller groups, you'll want to have a record of these. But the first form of pretend peace is what I will call peace through power. Peace through power. The second is what I'm calling peace without, and this is a big word, provocation. Clearly, I'm just looking for P's for alliteration's sake. I'm succeeding hugely. Peace without provocation. And the third is what I call personal peace. So peace. Peace through power, peace without provocation, personal peace. Lots of P's. Peace through power has been a part of our world, has been a part of human existence from the very beginning of life outside the garden. Some talk about it sometimes as peace through the sword. There is a kind of peace that exists when no one is fighting. And we go, oh, this is peace. This feels nice. Nobody's killing each other anymore. We're not worried about invading armies and things like that. But the reason that no one is fighting under peace through power is because of fear. During the time of Jesus, this was known as the peace of Rome. This was part of Rome's propaganda. Serve Rome and you will be protected by our peace. What they meant was you'll be protected by our sword. Caesar was actually seen and he was referred to as the great savior of the world. Wait a sec, that's familiar. The followers of Jesus were using the language that was being used of Caesar. But Caesar was called the savior of the world, of humanity. Why? Because he fought Rome's enemies in order to bring peace to the world. And this is an ancient form of peacemaking that continues today in our world. We see it in all sorts of places, but it takes different forms in all sorts of different ways. For Black History Month, I've been doing some just intentional reading about our stories, about our history, and I'm struck by the way that our context, our country has recreated again and again in different ways new illusions of peace. At first, it was the ability of white slaveholders to keep their black slaves from rebelling through the threat of violence. There were other ways as well. But then even once slaves had been freed, it was through acts of terror. Horrific acts of violence, lynching, burning crosses that former slaves were now being kept in line. When nobody was acting up or calling for some sort of fair or equal treatment, it was seen as peace. Everything is okay. But it wasn't peace, it was peace through the sword, through fear. Throughout history, we've seen people trust in power to provide peace. If we're honest, as people who live in the most powerful country in the world, we have often liked this peace very much and trusted in this peace. But in every culture and in every time, and our time apparently hasn't come yet, but it's fairly predictable, power always fails to maintain peace. In fact, the Bible shows us that peace through power locks us, enslaves us into a never-ending cycle of violence. Things might be quiet for a moment, but that's only because the tension is building beneath the surface. Jesus shows us a different way. If you have power, Jesus, who is God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but he emptied himself, taking on the form of a servant. And being found in human likeness, he humbled himself to death, even death on a cross. Just saying that line, even death on a cross, the fact that it doesn't sort of evoke audible gasps from us shows how like distant we are from what Paul was saying in Philippians 2. that Jesus would die the most shameful and humiliating of deaths as the God of all creation at the hands of his created beings. He clung to nothing, giving it all away. And so if you have power, imitate Jesus. James tells us that we should boast, the rich should boast when they are being humiliated. Another way to describe that is the powerful, as they are giving up their power, should boast that they have less power today than they had yesterday. If that sounds weird to you, it's because we're all a bit stained by the values of our kingdom, of the world that we live in. So if you have power, give it away. If you have no power, the Jesus we know as human had no standing. The Jesus who was from backwater Nowheresville town called Nazareth, who somebody once said, what good could come from Nazareth? Jesus refused to seek position or status. He avoided going to the places where the powerful people gathered. He wasn't looking to make a name for himself. In fact, gained a reputation for going to all the worst places and the nobody places and the least reputable places and eating with the people who you're not supposed to eat with if you're a person of status and honor. And so our world tells us that if you have power, you can use power to make peace. And our world tells us that if you don't have power, making peace requires getting access to power. But when you have been purified and you see the world according to Jesus, you realize that this is all backwards. You don't make peace by using your power. You make peace by giving it to the powerless. And you don't make peace by grasping for power if you don't have any. You make peace by celebrating your powerlessness and trusting that the God who raises the dead is able to humble the powerful and give you whatever power you might need to do his work. If this sounds crazy, it's because of how deeply shaped and formed we are by the ways of our world. The second kind of pretend peace is what I call peace without provocation. I think that this is actually one of the most common kinds of peace that we settle for. You might call it the McDonald's of peace because it's drive-through peace. It's the peace that just exists when we quickly do whatever we can to resolve any situation so there's no tension, so there's no conflict, so everything just feels nice and mellow. Nobody's stirring the water. There's no conflict. Nobody's complaining about anything. And so all is quiet. And man, we like to believe that when all is quiet, this is what peace is. But it's not peace. It's just quiet. There are lots of reasons why things might be quiet. But peace isn't necessarily one of them. If you know this, this is You have to know this, right? If human beings are in relationship with each other, if human beings are talking to each other and interacting with one another, like there will be conflict. There will always be conflict. Far too often we think that we have peace because we're not talking to each other and grumbling's happening kind of behind the scenes and we don't hear it. And so we think that everything is sort of good. But there's this reason why we've been called to peacemaking. It's a thing that's made constantly. It's just never done. It's never static. It's kind of like laundry. I don't know if that's a weird analogy, but do you ever finish laundry and then check it off your to-do list? If you put laundry on your to-do list and you check it off, you're gonna be angry all the time Because the moment you mark it off your to-do list, it's back on there. There's more laundry to do. Laundry never ends. Peacemaking is like laundry. What happens when you neglect your laundry for, depending on how many kids you have, a day? It piles up. It erupts. It feels unmanageable. Probably being a little bit dramatic about laundry. That's probably because Jane does most of our laundry. If things are quiet, the truth is it's because we've probably stopped talking to each other and we've stopped working for peace. That peace and peacemaking is actually marked by tension. It requires some tension. And might I even say some conflict. The other temptation with this kind of peace is to think that we can resolve all tensions and conflict quickly with an I'm sorry. We think that we can just sort of move things aside, set our differences aside and move on, agree to disagree, just look at each other and say, are we okay? Oh, we're okay? Okay, cool. And then not talk anymore. But again, peace is harder than that. And it's not just that it's hard in this thing that's like this obstacle that we gotta figure out. It's hard, but man, it is so good if we will enter into the hard work of peacemaking. And I'll talk a little bit more about why in just a minute, but James tells us that we have to confess our sins to each other. It's not enough to just say, I'm sorry. What are you sorry for? In what ways have you wronged someone else? We have to listen to each other. We have to be slow to get angry. We have to refuse to grumble. We have to accept that conflict is part of our lives as a family. But we are called to seek peace with God and seek peace with each other. And this just takes practice. Like, it actually takes practice and deliberate practice of like doing it and setting out to do it and being stretched by it. Which brings us to our third form of pretend peace. The wisdom from above is not about personal peace. And I want to elaborate on this a little bit because this one might be a little bit confusing, but it's common. I don't know if you experience this, but I found it to be common for Christians to justify disobeying Jesus by saying, I have peace about it. Like, there's this like crazy idea out there that if I feel some sort of personal internal peace, that it must be okay for me to not do what Jesus has asked me to do. But of course, James tells us at the end of chapter 4 that whoever knows the right thing to do and fails to do it, for them, it is sin. And James actually gives us an interesting illustration of this in chapter 2. James says, listen, if a brother or a sister is poorly clothed and lacking in daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, be warmed and filled, without giving them the things needed for the body, what good is that? James asks. That's a fascinating question, right? Did you hear what James is asking? James is criticizing the person who speaks of peace, who thinks that peace is something that if I just speak peace to you, that God will just give you some sort of peace that will make the fact that you're hungry and not housed okay, and it'll just be fixed. But James asks the question, like, what good is this word about peace? With the like answer being, it's not good. It's not good at all. It's not real peace. Which brings us back to, and we haven't talked about it at all, but the reading that we heard from Tom earlier, from the Gospel of John. Jesus has just been raised from the dead, and he comes to his disciples who are in this locked room, and he shows up, and three different times he speaks about peace to them. He speaks to his disciples, men and women who are in need. They're terrified in this room, and they've been given a job that they are not equipped for. But Jesus doesn't say to them what the person in James says, which is, go in peace and may you have everything you need, and then like leave. No, Jesus says, not go in peace, but peace be with you. He says it three different times. Peace be with you, and with the peace that he wants to go with them, he encourages them in the way that they need to be encouraged. He breathes his spirit on them and promises that his very spirit is going to indwell them. The spirit that they will need to do the work that they've been called to is going to be provided by him for them. He gives them clear direction. As the Father sent me, so I send you. And he gives them power. Whoever you forgive on earth will be forgiven. Now, think about what Jesus does. Jesus gives them what they need to make peace with each other and with God, and to invite others into the peace of God and into peace with them. Jesus sends them off with what they need. And so peace is with them. But how often do we pray for people that they would have peace, but we aren't actually willing to go with them or give them what they need so that peace goes with them? We're not willing to be peace with them or for them. That's the question that this sort of leaves us with. And so we have these three different kinds of false peace, and you can see in each of them how they're a distortion of or altogether different from the peace that Jesus brings and he invites us into. And so we think about peace through power, we think about peace without provocation, and we think about personal peace. All of these fall short of the peace that we experience in Jesus. None of these require us to imitate Jesus as peacemakers in the world. But the way of Jesus is a life of peacemaking. And James tells us that this work will bear fruit. James tells us that the world, our world, will overflow with a harvest of righteousness when we do the work that God has called us to of peacemaking. And what this means is that men and women and children coming into right relationship with our Father in heaven is a harvest of righteousness, of right relationship. Men and women and children from all different nations and languages and tribes coming into right relationship with each other as the family of God. This is righteousness. Right relationship, peacemaking sows the seeds of right relationship. This is what Jesus is inviting us into. Friends, I hope that you hear this. Know that God has made peace with you, and that he is inviting you into this life of making peace in the church and in the world. We're gonna spend a few minutes breaking off into groups, and I'll direct you with a diagram up there, but also help people around you find where they need to go. And these are the three questions I have two questions and a thing. We always end praying for each other. And I know that some of the groups sometimes get caught up in the first two questions and don't spend the time praying for each other. We don't have a ton of time, so try to like kind of move through them quickly and then pray for each other. But the first is, which of these three pretend pieces are you most tempted by? The peace through power, peace through provocation, without provocation, and personal peace. Sort of an internal peace without obedience. Which of these are you most tempted by? Who have you seen be a model for peacemaking? Who have you seen that you would say, this is a peacemaker in our midst. And then would you pray for each other for the wisdom that is peaceable?